Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am Mark Gillar. Our special guest today is Brian Sussman, conservative radio talk show host and the author of Climategate, a veteran meteorologist exposes the global warming scam. Brian, welcome to the show.
Mark, I love that intro. That was fantastic. Outgoing Midnight Massage Man. That's fantastic. And by the way, I know you do have a lot of people listening. I have that on good recommendation, so this is just a pleasure, especially on this day.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, especially on this day. And as far as the Al Gore opener, I mean, you know, I'm still new in radio, so I've got to make a dollar wherever I can. So if that means being called to Al Gore's hotel room at midnight, then that's what it means. I thought your book had an interesting intro. I've read just about every book on global warming out there, and or the lack thereof. And you start with a little history lesson on Marx and Lenin. Why don't you take our listeners through that, and then we can sort of explain how that ties into what's going on with the anthropogenic global warming scare.
Excellent point. You know, there are a number of books out on this topic, and some of them are actually quite excellent. What I wanted to do with Climategate was provide the reader with something unique. I wanted to give them, one, a comprehensive overview of the environmental movement and get to the global warming debate, and then try show what these elites, what these greenies, what these politicians want to do with the global warming crisis as they see it, and what we would stand to lose as Americans should they become successful. Now, the other thing I wanted to do in that was keep it really simple. You know, for 25 years I was on TV as a TV meteorologist and science reporter, and I won a lot of awards because I was able to take really complex scientific issues and boil them down into little 60-second nuggets that an audience on television could understand. So I've got this ability to just make the complex really simple, so I wanted to do that because at the end of the day I wanted this to be a global warming book people would actually read. I know a lot of folks buy these books. Then we get a chapter two in, and we're going, my gosh, this is heavy reading. So I tried to make it entertaining, tried to make it informative and easy to use. Now, getting back to your specific question, I've never written a book before, done a lot of writing, but never did a book. And I have a lot of friends who have written a lot of books, some of them very well known. And I would ask them, okay, you know, help me here. I want to make this count. What do I do to make a great book? One of the things one of my friends told me was, well, for starters, your opening line's really got to be a grabber. So, okay, I thought about that for quite a long time, and here's the opening line to the book. Global warming's story begins with a diabolical bastard named Karl Marx. Because, and that is a grabber, and that's gotten a lot of attention, but the truth is, Karl Marx saw himself, Mark, as a scientist. He really believed that he was a scientist, and he came up with some new laws. You know, a law in the world of science is like the law of gravity. You can't defy that. So he came up with some laws, not theories, not hypotheses, laws, and they were the laws of matter. And the laws of matter, if I could just boil those down in about 15 seconds.
Sure.
This. Some people are randomly spit out of their mother's womb with a better brain than others. And those with the better brain have some sort of responsibility or right to rule over those with the lesser brain, because otherwise, left to their own devices, those with the lesser brain will kill one another and destroy the planet. That's what Karl Marx believed. Hence, a heavy-handed form of government, hence lots of regulation, and hence, you know, much of the world as we see it today, and quite frankly, hence what we see a few people in Washington, D.C., and the various state houses trying to do to the rest of us to this very day. And if I could do another hence the rise of the Tea Party, because we're seeing through these shenanigans. We're realizing that, wait a second, they can't rule and regulate our lives. We don't need government to tell us what to do. So This is at the root.
Well, see, there you taught us something new, because I thought the Tea Party was just a movement by a bunch of racists who don't like an African American being in the White House. Right there. Thanks for the enlightenment.
Yeah, we don't want we're racists and we're religious bigots and we're all of that, according to the ruling elites. But there is an elitist class, and now they're in the White House, and where I live in California, they run Sacramento, which is our state capital, and they even include guys like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who claims to be a Republican but is cut from that same cloth. So, you know, we do have global warming story just coming right from Karl Marx. And it's interesting because you see what happened in the 1960s. We had a couple prominent books, and I talk about those at length, and others have as well, but I add some additional thoughts that no one's quite touched upon. And the two books at the time in the 1960s that really changed the face of the world in terms of making the environment a new hook that these elites could hang their hat on was Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which is just loaded with fraud, and the other book was Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich, who, by the way, still teaches just up the street from where we're talking right now at Stanford University, and he hasn't changed his tune one iota. Rachel Carson was trying to declare that the compounds and chemicals mankind uses were destroying the planet. Specifically, DDT was the compound she put in her crosshairs, which was a non-toxic, wonderfully effective agent for getting rid of mosquitoes. And, of course, mosquitoes carry malaria, and malaria kills millions of people each year. I really see her and her efforts, successful effort to ban DDT, as something Malthusians like Paul Ehrlich wanted all along. They want to eliminate broad swaths of the population of the Earth. And by banning DDT, quite frankly, she's responsible for millions of deaths of people, specifically in Africa and South America.
Let me stop you for just a sec. Brian, a lot of the people who argue for the book Silent Spring and her efforts will say that there are other pesticides just as effective as DDT that don't cause the harm to the environment, and that there's no reason why we shouldn't just substitute those for DDT.
Sure.
What are your thoughts whenever people make claims like that?
Well, that's a great point. First of all, DDT, there may be some other wonderful compounds out there, but DDT was completely and is completely non-toxic to humans and also to wildlife, including birds, which she said were dying because of the use of DDT. There's just no scientific proof to back up any of her claims. And, in fact, there's been scientific proof to actually show us that DDT may well be a cancer cure. So that's kind of an interesting one, but here's the great story that I provide in my book. When I was in San Jose, I was a TV meteorologist, and there was this professor at San Jose State, and this guy was an entomologist, and he had used DDT while working in World War II. His job was to dust the troops in Europe with DDT to keep typhoid from breaking loose. And so this is a guy, he breathed DDT. I mean, it was all over his body. And he never got any kind of disease, and he never got any kind of a cancer. In fact, he was so outraged by Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, that he became somewhat of an outspoken critic. And he would speak at, like, your local Rotary Club and various conventions, et cetera. And, again, you know, he's at San Jose State University. I'm at a TV station in San Jose. And I heard about this guy, and it was just amazing. At a Rotary Club, my co-anchor said, I just saw this guy. You won't believe what happened. He was at the Rotary Club. He's talking about Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, and he's talking about DDT, and he's a professor at San Jose State. And he opened up his speech by holding up a tall glass of water, taking a spoonful of DDT, placing it in the glass, stirring it up, and then he consumed the entire glass before our very eyes. And indeed, that's what he would do before every speech. He lived to be 84. He died while mountain climbing in Glacier National Park. But his point was DDT is just a wonderful compound that's cheap, it's non-toxic, and it's incredibly effective for taking out malaria. But my point, Mark, is this is just one of the layers of fraud that make up the foundation of the environmental movement. There are just tons of these layers. And so I have a chapter of the book entitled Foundation of Fraud, because the entire environmental movement is based on junk science, fraud, etc. And it has to be, because they're not operating from a truthful worldview. In fact, they're just trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes to put forward an agenda.
Well, let me share a personal story with you from my own family. My dad grew up on a farm. They used DDT in their agricultural business, and my dad would talk about his job being to, you know, spray the crops with DDT. And occasionally, while he was doing this, one of the nozzles would clog up. You know, he'd stop the tractor, get off, go around the back, unscrew the nozzle, put it in his mouth, blow on it, clear it out, put it back on, and go on with his job. And, you know, he's 74 now, going on 75, and doing fine. So I've got my own story from the family about,
that's a great one. And that just kind of adds to what I'm saying here. And I will tell you, I've received emails from people all over the world, especially in Europe, who have read my book, who have similar stories, because DDT was in such widespread use, you know, before and during World War II. So your story just kind of adds to all of these, and it's hilarious, and it's true.
Well, one of the other criticisms that I hear, and we'll get off of DDT in just a second, but a lot of people say that the mosquitoes, you know, have developed immunity to it. It no longer kills them. But I have seen, and I want your opinion on this, I've seen reports of studies that indicate that even in situations where the mosquitoes have developed a tolerance to it, the mosquitoes are still highly reluctant to light on a wall or a person or a roof that's been sprayed with DDT. Is that correct?
Yes, I've heard similar things, and there are some studies to suggest that as well, because, again, it's just a wonderful compound. Banned in 1973, malaria, of course, kills, I think the latest numbers I've seen, has killed 96 million people since 1973, and this really squares with the elitists. You know, I say in the book, when it comes to AIDS, and it comes to famine, and it comes to abortion, deep down in their heart, they're really all for these things because they'll eliminate large swaths of the population. In fact, it's Paul Ehrlich, this professor I was just telling you about, he's equated overpopulation with a cancer, and he says that cancer needs to be cut out. And sometimes those decisions to cut out the cancer are brutal and ruthless. Now, he's talking about the human population, getting rid of human population through brutal and ruthless means. These people are scary.
Oh, I think so, and I think perhaps Al Gore summarized it very well. If you've seen the movie by Phelan McAleer and Anne McElhaney, Not Evil, Just Wrong, they have a little clip of Al Gore in there saying the problem is coal, cars, and people. Now, I'm relatively attracted to coal-powered plants and cars. Those are favorites of mine. I like low-cost electricity fueling our economy, and I like the convenience of driving around in a car. But that last one, people, I took that personally. I don't understand why these environmentalists actually believe that the best thing they can do for the planet is get rid of a few billion people, and that seems to be their true motive in all of this.
Yes, and you know, I talk about this at length in ClimateGate, and I also talk about it in a new article that was just posted at humanevents.com yesterday in regards to James J. Lee, who was, of course, the Discovery Channel hostage taker who was taken out by police last week. But you look at what Lee was talking about. Lee said that humans, now this goes right along with what Al Gore just mentioned in that quote. He regarded as humans as, quote, the most destructive, filthy, pollutive creatures around. So
wow.
You get guys like Al Gore who inspired guys like James J. Lee, and James J. Lee also said that he was, quote-unquote, awakened by Al Gore. You look at all of these kooks, you know, these people are just a little off to begin with. Then they get these words spoken to them by Al Gore, or even James Hansen, who I talk a lot about in my book. James Hansen is the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. James Hansen is the keeper of the temperature record for the United States of America. And this guy is a friend of Al Gore's. He's actually spoken prior to the showing of Al Gore's films. And, you know, they're buds. There's no question about it. But this guy has actually gone so far to call coal trains, you know, trains carrying coal, as death trains. And he's encouraged young people to act up. Now, again, you're a little off-center, and you hear words like that. You hear words from Al Gore, and you think, my God, I've got to take matters into my own hands. I'm going to do a hostage-taking situation over at Discovery Channel. I'll force them to alter their program schedule to save the planet, and everything will be good. So this is scary. These people have rhetoric that is off the charts frightening, and they need to be held accountable for this.
Well, it's interesting because if Lee had been a disciple of Sarah Palin or Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh, the mainstream media would not have hesitated to connect those dots. But because it was Al Gore, you really don't hear a lot about it, do you?
Yeah, excellent point. I was in an interview earlier this week with a newspaper, and they were talking to me about my assertion that Al Gore and James Hansen and Paul Ehrlich are people that feed these kooks to go off. And so this guy tried to pin me down, and he was making an analogy similar to yours, but it wasn't quite as sophisticated. He said, "Well, what about Timothy McVeigh? So you're saying that all those right wingers fed him his dose of hate, so he would take out that building in Oklahoma?" I said, "Can you give me some specific examples, because I don't know exactly what you're talking about. Who said what that caused him to go off? I really need examples." Well, the guy said, "Well, you know, just the overall, you know, big government is bad, that kind of thing." I said, "Well, I need specifics." So he kept pressing me. I said, "Listen, buddy, I'm not taking the bait. I know where you want to go with this. I'm not taking the bait. But you make a better point, Mark. This is exactly, and I mean, this guy's point confirms yours. This is where they want to take the debate. And they're two completely separate issues. I don't hear all of the media, the conservative media hosts that you just mentioned, including Sarah Palin, inciting people to violence. I hear Al Gore in his book, Earth in the Balance, talking about, he talks about one of the, well, let me see, I'll get the exact quote here. He likens the environmental situation that we're in to a war. And he actually says that, let me find the great quote here. He said, "Isolated pockets of resistance fighters who have experienced this firsthand have begun to fight back in inspiring but woefully inadequate ways." He's encouraging resistance fighters for the assault on Earth, which he says is breathtaking and horrific. That's an incitement to violence. I don't hear Sarah Palin talking like that. I don't hear Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Brennan down the line talking like that. But I do hear these other characters likening this to a war. If we don't do something now, the planet is going to end. That's crazy talk, and that's the kind of talk that's all the crazy talk a kook needs to go off.
Well, I agree with you. There's a lot of that going on, and I know that Al Gore has tried to fire up young people in his presentations, both at the high school and the collegiate level, comparing the whole climate thing to discrimination. And, you know, he said, as a young person, you know, we would challenge our parents, like, you know, why is it okay to discriminate against these people? Why is that right again? So he basically implied that the old folks don't get it. Just like the old folks didn't get why discrimination was wrong, but young people are able to get things that their parents can't. And I think a young lady who was present at one of those talks actually secretly tape recorded it and was able to go on Fox and play some of that tape. But yeah, he's basically looking for, a return to the type of civil disobedience that we saw in the 60s. And let's face it, that was the glory days for the liberals anyway. And they all want to get hold hands, sing Kumbaya, and talk about war and the planet going to hell and that type of thing.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, with Al Gore, we have to remember he's been on this crusade for many, many years. When he was vice president, he was in charge of Bill Clinton's Council on Sustainable Development. And this council came up with a report called the New Consensus Report. And here's what the New Consensus Report said. And again, this is a report that wasn't law, but essentially it certainly was policy that that produced soft law and became the motivation for so much of what we're seeing right now in both the environmental movement and for example, the EPA. But this is an official government document that said the federal government, and this is, again, produced by Al Gore, the federal government should play a more active role in building consensus on difficult issues. So, in other words, we got to make people think that there are a whole bunch of us that believe that this is the absolute truth. And why do we want to do that? Well, he says. He says because, quote, we believe economic growth, environmental protection, and social equity are linked. Now, it seems to me that economic growth is an issue all by itself. Environmental protection is a separate issue all by itself. And social equity, which is redistribution of wealth, is a separate issue all by itself. But Al Gore has said, and you see this in UN writings and just in so many different places, these three things are linked. The environment will be used as a hook to bring forth a socialist-type economy where there is redistribution of wealth. So he admits it, and he's been admitting it for the longest time. It's not about the environment to Al Gore. It's about social change, and I think in recent years, more than anything else with Al Gore, it's about making tons of money. And in the book Climategate, I came across, you know, just a beautiful gift in that of a buddy of mine who I only knew from this particular charity that we were involved in together, and I didn't know much about the guy's life. I knew that he was a Green Beret. He's a pretty young guy. He's only in his 40s. But he was a Green Beret, and that's all I knew about him. And now I know him from this charity. And I concluded a broadcast out here in San Francisco one day, and I had talked about Al Gore and his association with some of these venture capital groups in the Silicon Valley. And I said, you know, based upon Al's association with some of these venture capitalist groups and this proposed carbon exchange that that people want to create, I think this guy's going to make millions off of global warming. I received a phone call from my friend who I call Dave in the book, not his real name. But I received a phone call from Dave after that broadcast, and Dave said, hey, Brian, I want to let you know, I actually work with Al Gore in the Valley, and you're wrong. He's not going to make millions. And he paused, and I thought, oh, my gosh, this is a troubling call. And my friend went on to say, he's going to make billions, with a B, billions of dollars, and I'm sick of this nonsense, and I'm going to meet with you tomorrow, and I'm going to give you a stack of documents to blow the lid off this thing. So we met at a Starbucks in Cupertino, California, right by the Apple headquarters, and he had this satchel, and he produced about an inch and a half thick stack of documents, and he said, it's all open source, there's nothing here that's hidden, no top secrets, I'm just saving you about a year's worth of research. And he showed me how Al Gore and others stand to make these billions of dollars because of global warming. And it was fascinating, and I include that in the book. And there was actually more that I could have included, but because I footnote everything very, very carefully, I just didn't want to put myself in a libelous situation because some of this stuff was, I couldn't really reference properly, but everything that I could reference is in the book. And it's mind-blowing that there are people, these guys don't care about the environment. They're rather amoral in that they just see this as a great money-making opportunity. Just like the internet boom, where a handful of people were able to make huge, huge dollars, while many, many, many others lost the shirts off their back because of stupid investments. And so that's exactly what's going to happen with the Green Revolution and this carbon exchange, should they be able to build it out.
Well, speaking of cap and trade, you have an interesting quote in the book, actually on page 15, where I believe Paul Ehrlich, speaking before the United Nations in Cairo, actually drew upon his writing pal John Holdren and talked about envisioning a complex future energy cap and trade program by which the gap between rich and poor nations would be closed. I think that pretty much says it all.
Boy, that's a good one. And, you know, it's funny because I've kind of forgotten about that quote, and that really does sum it up. You know, I get so fixated on other parts of my book, but that's from 1994, and it was an address entitled Too Many Rich People. And you're right. This is one of the goals. So, you know, again, it seems to me the environment should be a separate issue, population should be a separate issue, and economy should be a separate issue, redistribution of wealth, but they blend all of these together because these people are hell-bent for leather on changing the world as we know it. That's what they want to do. And when they talk about the gap between the rich and the poor being closed, you know, that's why these elites look at places like Vietnam and they think, oh, what a wonderful country. Yeah, sure, it's communist, but look at, everybody has a job, they make clothes, they have an agrarian society to a large extent to this day. They look at Cuba, everybody gets health care, everybody has an education. They look at Venezuela and they see the same things. This is sickening, but this is what they envision for the United States of America. And that's why I wanted to write the book and throw off the gloves in the process, because while my other friends have written some wonderful books on global warming, no one has touched upon the social and political dynamic the way I do. And I just, again, I call it what it is. It's communism. I call it what it is. It's socialism. I call it what it is. It's un-American. And that's what you'll find in the book ClimateGate.
Yeah, I guess you made the point that whether you're calling it collectivism, socialism, or communism really just depends on your degree of political correctness.
Yeah, you're right, because with Karl Marx, he used those terms interchangeably. He didn't care. He used them interchangeably. So I don't have a problem with doing that either. If it was good enough for Marx, well, heck, it's good enough for me.
I like that. Let's talk about Al Gore just a little bit more. I have to admit, you've done something in your book that I have not seen in many of the other global warming books. You actually are able to footnote the Al Gore claim that he invented the Internet. I had actually been one of those people that was starting to doubt whether or not he'd ever said it, but apparently it took place in an interview on CNN with Wolf Blitzer. Tell us more.
Yes, it's Al Gore, we always hear the quote, you know, he invented the Internet. But this was on Wolf Blitzer, and I don't have the footnote before me, but he said, I invented the initiative, I think that's the exact quote, for the Internet. And he really did say that. I mean, this is not just made-up stuff. He really did say that he invented the initiative for the creation of the Internet, which is ludicrous because the military and academia had been using, you know, some form of the Internet for quite some time before he ever said that.
The old ARPANET.
Yeah. You know, I mean,
for example.
So this is just the way Al Gore talks. So what I describe in the book is, you know, just the hypocrisy of Al Gore, and it is the most damning book ever written about Al Gore. In fact, my chapter 5 is called Gore on the Grill. And this is a man who from the very get-go was just, I mean, some might say he's a pathological liar. I don't know, but he's just always had this tendency to make things up ever since he was a little kid. And, you know, keep in mind.
I'm sorry to laugh so much, man, but you said kid, and that triggered a memory. One of the things he talks about is his mom gathering them around the table to read Silent Spring. If you look at when Silent Spring was published and when it gained traction, he would have had to have been around 17 when his mom was doing that. I've got a 19-year-old. There is no way in hell my son would sit still for my wife calling us all around the kitchen table and reading Silent Spring or whatever the latest environmental junk science book happens to be. I'm going to go on record as saying I don't believe for one second that ever happened, any more than I believe Hillary Rodham Clinton was named after the mountain climber. I mean, I just don't believe it. These people have a way of fantasizing things about their childhood. You know, Al Gore, you can go back to when he ran for president. He had the story of the old lady that had to pick up cans to survive week to week, and her family came forward, and the truth is she was financially fine. She had family members taking care of her. She was not collecting tin cans because that's the only way she could, or aluminum cans because that's the only way she could eat. The guy just has a way of making stuff up. I mean, after he departed the White House, a very expensive bust of Abraham Lincoln that was missing from the White House was found at his house. He called it a mistake on the part of one of his staffers. He has a long history of saying whatever fits the bill.
I wish I would have included that one in the book because that's just the bust of Lincoln is just a hilarious story. One of his staffers, right? The other things we have to remember about Al Gore, first of all, his dad was good buddies with, and he became good buddies with, this character named Armin Hammer. And Armin Hammer, you know, had incredible ties to the communist world and communist Russia. But this is a story I added in the book about Al, and I think this is just incredible. 1987, we're still in the Cold War. Russia is not our friend. Russia seeks to destroy the United States. Al Gore is a senator then from Tennessee, and of course, you know, first he was a member of the House of Representatives, and that's when he was pro-life. He becomes a member of the Senate, sees his elitist star rising, quickly drops the pro-life platform, and really ticked off a lot of his constituents in Tennessee. But Senator Al Gore and Armin Hammer, now again, Armin Hammer is a friend of Stalin back in the day. Armin Hammer and Al Gore fly to Moscow on a private plane where Hammer is about to receive a humanitarian award from the International Physicians Against Nuclear War. This is a communist group. He's going to communist Russia to receive a humanitarian award. Now, there are a lot of Tea Partiers, and I meet them all the time here in the San Francisco Bay Area. There are a lot of Tea Party members, some of them extremely outspoken, who are from the former Soviet Union. They will tell you, to a man or woman, that there was no such thing as humanitarianism in the former Soviet Union. People were imprisoned for their thoughts. And here they are having a humanitarian conference in the Soviet Union. So Al Gore goes there with Armin Hammer, and Al Gore actually speaks to this group. He spoke to 2,000 communists and communist sympathizers in attendance who were advocating nuclear disarmament, which, of course, was aimed at weakening the United States of America. This is Al Gore in 1987. So Al Gore has a history of this stuff. And again, you know, Al Gore, just chock full of lies. I tell a great story in here. He always tells us how he went to Harvard, and he makes it sound like he was this great student. I go through his record at Harvard, which was pathetic, and he talks about this great mentor he had at Harvard named Dr. Revell. And I go through this story. Dr. Revell, I'm assuming that Al Gore knew him, but Dr. Revell was no believer in global warming, let me tell you. And yet Al Gore makes it sound like this is the guy that convinced him that the world was about to implode. So I go into a brilliant story on that. And then there's another story here. You know, we tend to have these short memories, and obviously with so many things happening. I talk about in 1992 a television debate between Admiral Stockdale and Al Gore. You know, they were both running for the vice presidential positions at the time. And
Stockdale being Ross Perot's vice presidential candidate.
Thank you very much. And this was just so stinking hilarious. I guess Dan Quayle was there as well. But at the end of the day, Al Gore became such a laughingstock because of the fraud that people were aware of in his life regarding Dr. Revell and global warming, etc., that the moderator of this debate actually had to have the crowd settle down and stop laughing at Al Gore because, you know, 1992, people were a little more aware of Al Gore's background than they are today. He was a joke in 1992, and he was almost laughed off of the stage to the point where the moderator of this debate had to ask the audience to stop laughing at Al Gore. He was a joke then. Somehow he was able to repair his credibility over the years, but at the end of the day, the guy is just a complete, complete joke.
Well, I liked Bush 41's moniker that he hung on Al Gore, Ozone Man. I thought that was great. I still refer back to that, and I thank Bush 41 for coming up with that. It's an accurate term. Al's just one of those guys. I mean, I can't get past the thing about his mom reading him Silent Spring. I don't believe it, and I think, like a lot of politicians, he just says whatever happens to be convenient at the time. Now, the other thing about Al Gore that makes him unbelievable, though, is the hypocrisy in his lifestyle. He's kind of one of those do as I say, not as I do type people. When you look at Al Gore's life, what types of things jump out at you as being hypocritical?
Well, you know, certainly the homes in which he lives, homes plural, and he has several of them. He's got one in San Francisco. I mean, this is just in a beautiful high rise. It has complete valet service. In other words, he has butlers available. He's only in this house, I would guess. Yeah, he probably sneaks in maybe every month or so because he does have some business. Well, he's got tons of business interests in the San Francisco Bay Area, but he'll go up to this beautiful pad in San Francisco. What I think is a laugher about that, if you watch his movie An Inconvenient Truth, according to Al, within decades of where his wonderful condominium or whatever you want to call it, it's a multi-million-dollar deal, where it's located, that's going to be under about 10 feet of water, according to Al Gore, in about 20 years. So I just think it's laughable that he talks about, you know, the sea level rising in San Francisco and other places being swamped. Well, that's exactly where his high-rise is located. Then he's got this new pad down in Santa Barbara, cost $9 million. He and Tipper bought this just before they split up. And this sucker is gigantic. And then he's got the other pad, of course, in Tennessee, and we've all heard the stories about how his utility bill was running something like $30,000 a month. And then after he retrofitted it to become, quote-unquote, green, the price of the cost of running that house was even higher. So I don't know what he was doing in terms of his green retrofits, but he ended up using more energy after the retrofits than before. And you know what's funny? I mentioned this in the book Climategate. George W. Bush, you know, say what you want about the guy, but his house out there near Waco, the ranch, that was
Crawford,
really,
Crawford, Texas.
Yeah, right outside of
Waco. I'm 100 miles away from Waco, so.
Oh, cool. Okay, so where am I speaking to you from, if I may ask?
College Station, Texas, home of Texas A&M and the George Bush Library.
Okay, well, I have a son who goes to school in Abilene. So
I
get down to your neck of the woods. And by the way, I just might add as an aside, I'm sure that before I die, that's where my wife and I are going to move because Texas is a whole other country, and we love it down there, especially being out here.
Love to have you here.
Well, you know, we're out here in the Socialist Republic of California, and it gets pretty tough sometimes. But getting back to that place, you know it, in Crawford. I mean, this, you talk about green. My gosh, the systems that were employed by the architect who put together that ranch house in Crawford, whew, man, they've got geothermal, they've got the solar, they've got the collecting rainwater, they're doing all sorts of things, and Bush never talked about it. It was just not a big deal to him. But the other thing that I find just hypocritical about Al Gore, I mean, you look through this guy's life. In 2000, according to the records, the public records, when he ran for president, he had to disclose all this. Unless he was lying, he was worth $2 million, according to IRS figures and other disclosures that he was able to give to the public. So 2000, he loses the election, and what happens right after that? I mean, my gosh, this guy becomes the luckiest man on the planet. First, he has no experience at all in the investment world, unless you consider mistakenly, quote unquote, taking illegal campaign donations from a Buddhist temple in California as being an investment deal. But remember when he was caught doing that? He's caught red-handed taking illegal campaign donations from a Buddhist temple. And, I didn't realize what I was doing here. So to me, that was his only involvement in the investment world. He goes from that to co-founding a financial investment firm called Metropolitan West. This is in 2001. He co-founds this group, Metropolitan West. Metropolitan West is sold to Wachovia Bank 2 years later for $50 million. Now, where does this dope come up with that kind of financial acumen? He makes a deal like that, boom, boom, in 2 years makes $50 million. In 2001, he's recruited to be an advisor to Google. He gets all sorts of stock prior to Google going public. I mean, that's worth untold millions of dollars. And from there, he just starts to rack it up with all these sweetheart deals. Now, who are these people he's involved with? Obviously, they're not selecting Al Gore because he's a financial genius. They're selecting Al Gore because he's a useful idiot who can go out there and talk things up for them. Each one of these groups that he got involved with, including Google, are involved in green technology, green investments, green schemes, etc. So he just continues to have been hired by people who saw him as their spokesperson. And this is one of the reasons why, of course, he had to win that Nobel Prize. This is why he had to win the Oscar, because if they could get him to win the Nobel, it gave them more credibility as investment firms as having Al Gore on their board talking up global warming. If they could get him to win the Oscar, it would make them more valuable in terms of their investments. So this is what they've done with Al Gore. And my friend Dave, who I talked about earlier in the interview here, has been in closed-door meetings with Al Gore at a particular firm in the Silicon Valley, and he has told me that when this guy gets up to speak, and my friends actually debated him in these small groups of about 40 to 50 investors, he said the guy he's uncouth, he's sloppy, he's perpetually overweight and sweating, and he will not take anyone's, he will not be crossed by anyone. If you cross him, he will try to belittle you. He will try to call names. He doesn't want to debate with anybody. And my friend referred to him as, quote-unquote, piggish. Now, all this may sound tacky coming from me, but I'm just telling you, this is the way the guy operates. And they're using him as a tool to go ahead and score billions of dollars. And I estimate in my book that he's probably worth up to half a trillion dollars now. He's got a lot, half a billion dollars now. He's got a lot of money, and he stands to make even more, for example, should cap and trade actually pass.
My understanding is that he's poised himself through his investments to be worth well over $1 billion should cap and trade go through. And so if he's already halfway there from what you're telling us. We've got about 5 minutes left here in the scheduled segment. So let me ask you, as far as your book is concerned, let's talk about ClimateGate per se. I had to laugh at some of the attempts by the mainstream media to discount ClimateGate. Of course, the first quote that came out was that, you know, we're going to use Mike's trick to hide the decline. And the mainstream media was saying, well, it's all about semantics. We saw Dr. Gerald North from Texas A&M go on Fox and say, well, you know, a trick. It's a clever way of doing things. In scientific circles, that just, you know, it's a smart way. That's a good little trick. Of course, he admitted after the Fox interview that he hadn't actually read any of the ClimateGate emails. So sort of summarize for us the crime against humanity that was ClimateGate, because there are so many attempts to discount it, to say it's no big deal, it was only a handful of scientists, forgetting the fact of the CRU's importance in the climate world. But just sort of summarize the crime itself.
Yeah, this is very, very important. And this, of course, was so serious that it screwed up the Copenhagen Climate Summit earlier this year. CRU is the premier institute for keeping the world's temperature. It was founded in 1972 by a brilliant man, Dr. H.H. Lamb, who, by the way, went to his grave in 1997 not believing in global warming. He did not believe it. And Professor Lamb had even put a graph together of the last 1,000 years saying, you know, in the medieval times it was 2 degrees warmer than it is today, and in more recent years prior to 1850 it was 2 degrees colder than today. And that was the graph used by the United Nations when it came to the climate of the Earth. As soon as he died, they threw that graph under the bus and they came up with a new graph saying, no, temperature's been flat until the last several decades where it spiked upward. That's called the hockey stick graph. So in these emails from CRU, now I contend, and I've written about this extensively at AmericanThinker.com, and also if you go to my website, DebateMeAlGore.com, you'll find it's a great website, DebateMeAlGore.com. So I believe the emails were leaked, not hacked, and that's because when they were posted on this server in Russia, it became very clear right off the top that somebody was essentially saying, and I paraphrase here, we wanted to get the word out. We wanted to let you know what's happening behind the scenes. This was not a hack. This was a leak. Okay, but nonetheless, what did we find in these leaked emails? We found scientists at the CRU threatening to, quote, kick the crap out of skeptics and deniers. We heard
I had Patrick Michaels on the show.
Okay, well, you know. Yeah, he's the guy we're talking
about.
Kick crap out of Patrick Michaels. Another guy which sadly you couldn't have on the show, and he was brilliant, John Daly. He's since died. He was just a great blogger. You can still go to his website, johndaly.com. And they cheered his death, literally. So, you know, there were all these investigations, and they also stifled attempts by the Freedom of Information Act to gain, documentation as to where they were coming from on certain issues involving climate change and global warming. So there were several investigations, and the most recent investigation said, well, you know, cheering the death of a global warming skeptic and threatening to kick the crap out of Professor Michaels, that's just the way people talk on the Internet. Well, I don't talk like that on the Internet. You don't talk like that on the Internet.
No.
But this sort of brushed it aside. Then regarding the attempts to not come forward and comply with the Freedom of Information Act, they said, well, at the end of the day, they did. So, you know, no harm, no foul. But they wouldn't ask the most important question, and that is, where did they come up with their data to come up with this graph that shows that the last 30 or 40 years have been the hottest in world history? We want to know how they manufactured that graph. They wouldn't come forward and give us any of that information. So these investigations have been ridiculous. They're excusing just absolutely foul behavior, and they're excusing efforts to stonewall with the Freedom of Information Act. But then the most important question, okay, where'd you come up with the data? We want to see the data to see how you came up with this graph. They completely left that alone, and that's why I think the whole investigation process was a joke. And I'm sure that Dr. Lamb, and by the way, Dr. Lamb has a son in the Parliament in the UK right now, and I know that this son is no fan of the CRU, and this son believes that his father's rolling in his grave right now looking at what they've done to his wonderful institution. But this is what's happening. And my contention is, Mark, you know, in the world of science, there are PhDs with an agenda, and they will lie right through their teeth. Now, some are saying, well, how could scientists lie? They have advanced degrees, so they're sworn to the truth. Okay, let me give you an example. A lawyer has an advanced degree, and a lawyer is sworn to tell the truth. We all know that there's a large percentage of lawyers that are absolute crooks. They will lie right through their teeth, look you in the eye, and tell you one thing and do something else. Why can't we believe that to happen in the scientific community? Well, that is what's happening. These are PhDs with an agenda. They want to see a socialized slash communist slash collectivist world come before their very eyes in their own time. And these are people who are utilizing science in a junky way in order to put forward their agenda. And that's really, at the end of the day, the argument that I'm making in Climategate. And I think that's why the book has resonated with so many, because 300 footnotes, no one's been able to debate me on any of these issues. Nobody wants to, because the book is just so doggone well referenced.
It certainly is that. It certainly is that. As I mean, the example I threw out at the beginning of the show, I mean, you're the first person that's ever actually cited that Gore interview where he made the claim. I was impressed, because so many of the warmists, so many of the global warming alarmists claim that he never said that, and that was just manufactured by the right. And you've actually got the footnote there that proves that it is something that he said.
And Mark, you know, we have to do it with the little things, and we have to do it with the big things to maintain our credibility on our side of the political spectrum. And so that's why, even with a quote like that, I wanted to source it, just so somebody couldn't point a finger at me and say, oh, you know, another one of these right-wing whack jobs doesn't know what the heck he's talking about.
Oh, it's amazing the names they call you. I've even, even when I was just starting out blogging, the names I would be called, because I would go into some of these sites where the Al Gore supporters tended to hang out. And, you know, I was everything from on the take, from the oil industry to, a shill for Lord Monckton and other, deniers. And it was amazing the things they came at me with. And there was one guy in particular, and I'm not going to mention his name, but he's a well-known computer expert, who hangs out at one of these sites, who went as far as to research my home address.
Wow.
And state on the site the exact number of miles that I was located from Texas A&M University. And then one day I was logging on to classmates.com,
and apparently he wasn't aware of this, even though he was a computer expert. When you visit someone's page on classmates.com, you have the option of erasing the visit. Well, he didn't do that, so I was able to see that the same guy who posted this information about my home location was digging around on my page on classmates.com. So it, I guess looking for some piece of dirt, looking for something some student may have, fellow student may have said about me, I don't know. But it's interesting to me that this guy was so threatened by, you know, someone like myself, completely unknown, was making on that website that he went as far as to, I would call it a subtle threat.
Yeah, I would say a subtle threat. Yeah, that really,
yeah,
that's,
yeah.
You know, that's frightening. That's when they go to that depth and take that much time to research something like that, they are. It's a veiled threat, and they could put your life at risk. This is what they're doing to us. As you know, that's why you have this broadcast. That's why you're getting the truth out. And that's why we're doing what we're doing as Tea Party Patriots, to make sure that we have an opportunity to set the record straight and get this country back to its constitutional underpinnings.
Absolutely. And for those of you interested in Mr. Sussman's setting straight of the record, I butchered that, but at any rate, Climate Gate is a great book. I would recommend that everybody grab a copy of it. And the way this is working right now on Blog Talk Radio, Brian, is that people listening to this broadcast can actually see a photograph of your book. And if they will click on that book, it will transport them directly to Amazon.com, where they will be able to purchase a copy of the book. So I would encourage everyone to do that. Brian, we're out of time, almost out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to tell the audience before you go?
No, we're in the fight of our lives right now to reclaim this great republic that has been given to us with the sweat and blood of so many who came before us. And we're under assault from a lot of different levels right now. As you know, we've got an out-of-control regime in Washington, D.C., who sees the Constitution as something they can just run over. We've got Islamo-fascists beholden to take over this country for Mohammed. And we've got the Greenies, who also want to just usurp our ability to have adequate amounts of water, energy, and land. So these are trying times. We need to remain vigilant. We need to be grounded in the truth. We have to remember the pillars of morality and virtue. And we need to go forward for the sake of this great nation.
Brian, thank you very much for being here. Once again, the name of the book is Climate Gate, A Veteran Meteorologist Exposes the Global Warming Scam. You can get a copy by clicking on the link at the bottom of the page. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
All right, good man. I look forward to it again.
Oh, we'd love to have you back. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We are going to take a quick break for a public service announcement, and we will be right back with Susie Baruth to tell us about how she has expanded her former group, Protectors of Fallen Soldiers, and we'll be right back with that after this public service announcement.
Global warming is a reality, right? Wrong. Over 32,000 scientists, 9,021 of which hold doctoral degrees, recently signed a petition denouncing global warming as a flawed theory. A growing body of scientists agree that the rise in CO2 levels is a natural event and not man-made. Did you know that this hoax will cost us over $45 trillion by 2050? Together, we can stop the global warming hoax. Visit CAGWH.com and get involved today.
Okay, and we're also going to take a station break for station identification. Give me just one moment to crank that up. And here we go.
You're listening to WGRV in Flactonia, Texas, the flagship station of the Tea Party Power Hour.
Okay, and we are back with Susie Baruth. Let me go ahead and click this so we can get you on. Susie, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, Susie, thank you for being with us today. I know that you have expanded your group and you're doing all kind of great things. I know there's an Adopt-a-Soldier program and you've added several new components to your group. Tell us about that.
Okay, not only are we taking on the same as we did before, where we are counter-protesting the WBC, Westboro Baptist Church, We are also attending funerals that are not being protested using the Department of Defense listing for the killed in action soldiers. We are also adopting soldiers that are downrange in Afghanistan and Iraq, sending care packages and sending pen pal letters. We're just getting ready to launch a new concept, making it a fourfold concept cause, where we're going to be welcoming soldiers at the airport when they come home and sending them off at the airport when they go to leave. So that has not started yet, but that will be coming on in about, hopefully within the next month.
Well, I can tell you that I was in an airport when a group of soldiers came through, and all the employees at the airport and all the people standing around waiting on their flights walked out into the main areas and began clapping to receive them home. And I did see an incredible look of appreciation on their faces, noting how much we all appreciated their service. So this is just a great thing we can do for these people who give their lives to keeping us free.
Right, right. A lot of people say don't bother doing that because their families are there, and you know you're not gonna get anywhere. You know, don't waste your time, but. We're going to go ahead and do it anyways. We're going to be there. I don't care if their families are there or not. We're going to shake hands and give them hugs. And especially sometimes their families can't be there, and there's a soldier there with maybe their family can't be there, and he's the only one out of 100 that doesn't have anybody there. And so we're going to add that on. So instead of a threefold concept, we're going to take on a fourth one.
Well, talk to me about the Adopt a Soldier program. How does that work?
Well, what we're doing is right now we are working with AnySoldier.com and AnyMarine.com, and well, I am. And what I do is I request 2 soldiers per day. I'm trying to get a mass list going where I have my members email me on Facebook, and they give me their address, and I request a soldier for them, and I give them the soldier's name and address, and they send them a letter or a care package, flat box or whatever they call it. I'm not exactly sure what the box is actually called, but it's free. You fill out a customs form, and it's a free box that they send. And the soldier actually lists, they register with AnySoldier.com, and they list what they want or need, and the people try to send them things. Right now, I just adopted a whole unit in Iraq, 38 soldiers and their leader. I call him the leader because I don't know exactly what their soldier authority figure is called. I call him the leader. He takes care of 38 soldiers, men and women. And, they're in a whole unit. So, it takes a while, 2 per day, you know, it takes a while to get, that many soldiers. I have plenty of people in the cause. I have backed up cause members waiting for soldiers' names because it's hard to get names if you can only get 2 per day, and you can only get 10 per month. So I've already racked up my allotted amount of names for the month of September. So I'm trying to get approval to get a bunch of names at one time. I'm having a hard time doing that because of security reasons.
Mm.
So I'm working on that.
So you're in need of people to help you obtain names for this cause.
Not really. I'm not wanting to. I'm wanting the authority figures in charge of AnySoldier.com and AnyMarine.com to give me the authority to give me names. I don't want members getting their own names. That would defeat my purpose. You can get groups of names. It's just that with my cause, they think it's a security risk giving members names. They don't want each member to have a name.
Hey, Shirley, give me 1 second. I want to alert everyone that we are going to be going over on time. Now, for those of you listening live, the broadcast will end, but you can pick up the rest of the interview on the archive. Okay, we are now officially in archive time. But go ahead, Shirley, continue with what you were saying.
Well, actually, it's Susie, not Shirley.
Oh, I did it again. Wow, I apologize. I had, for listeners who weren't listening a few weeks ago, I had Susie on the same day that I had Shirley on from the Westboro Baptist Church, and I confused that all day long. So, Susie, I really apologize.
That's okay. Speaking of Shirley,
we need to get those dates out.
What dates?
Well, wherever they're appearing next. How do the listeners find out about that?
Today, they are actually supposed to be in 7 different funerals and burning the Koran. Well, they should have burned it at 12 o'clock. And the American flag at 12 o'clock, and attended 6 funerals today, all at one time.
Wow! You're in Florida, so the guy there backed down from burning the Koran, but the Westboro Baptist Church, not wanting to lose an opportunity, has decided to do it for him.
Well, that's what they had on their schedule. I don't know that they actually did it, but that's what they had on their schedule. But they had an awful busy day. That's what I can say. I don't know. I attended a veteran's funeral this morning down in Port St. Lucie with the Patriot Guards.
And did they show there?
No, they didn't. They were supposed to attend a funeral in near Titusville with a soldier that came back from Afghanistan. And it was about the same amount of mileage for me to go either to the veteran or the soldier. And I knew that the WBC wasn't going to show up at Titusville, so I went to the veteran's funeral. They had one scheduled for Missouri, and the street that the high school was on was called American Veterans Drive, and so they had it on their picket schedule as well, and so they threatened to picket the school and threatened to protest the funeral. So I believe that if they were going to be anywhere today, they would have gone there.
You've said they have a recent history of not showing up, and that's pretty much been the case since your group and the Patriot Riders amassed a group of about 12 to 1,300 people, and basically, I think in your words, kind of ran them off. I mean, they kind of got scared or intimidated. I mean, not that you did anything verbally or physically to threaten them, but just the sheer numbers of people seemed to, would it be fair to say, shake them up a little bit? Would that be overboard?
Well, yeah, that was as of our last interview, but since then, Shirley went to court. She did get off on her court case, but right after her court case, she proceeded to have a big protest in Omaha. They let her off, and then she went to a funeral. They let her off on a Thursday or on a Wednesday. And Saturday there was a funeral in Omaha, and there was such a big protest that it almost turned out to be a, I'm not sure the word I want to use, but it was dangerous, where our side was against their side, and the street was in the middle, and they were about ready to cross each other's side of the street. and a guy, it was on CNN, where a guy went through the street in a truck, and he, the guy was from our side, and he attempted to pepper spray the WBC member, but accidentally sprayed our leader from My Cause, who was trying to get the kids out of the street, and he accidentally sprayed her and got it in her eyes. She wound up going to the hospital, and so we lost our leader from finishing her job as our cause member. He got arrested because he had his child in the car, and Shirley was singing her God Bless America, her version of God Bless America, which is not God Bless America. It's just Shirley's version. And so it got way out of control. It's the worst protest that I've heard of since I've been doing this since last May. So
can you give us an idea of how many people were on both sides of the street that day?
I would say probably about 50 on each side. And Omaha is the worst place that there can be a funeral, because they get arrested whenever they go to Omaha, and they had just had a court case in Omaha, and two court cases within 2 weeks in Omaha, and they got out of both of them, and then they proceeded to have this protest, and boy, they turned it on and burned the flag. They burned the flag. They did everything they could. They crossed the line, which they never crossed the line. They crossed the line. They did a whole bunch of stuff. And now this guy that sprayed the pepper, he will no doubt get sued by the WBC, even though they didn't get him with the pepper spray. He attempted to spray him. So they'll sue him.
One would have to wonder what the actual damages would be in a case like that. But, you know, it's interesting because obviously your group doesn't advocate what this gentleman did. I mean, you don't want anybody on your side spraying anybody on the other side with pepper spray. But you mentioned Nebraska, and I posted a video on YouTube a while back where I guess the founder of the organization, Fred Phelps, was saying thank God for four dead Boy Scouts, and he talked about the fact that these four Boy Scouts who were killed in a tornado somehow were punishment from God, because the states of Nebraska and Iowa had, I think he sort of said persecuted, I don't know if he meant persecuted or prosecuted, but because they were going after the WBC. Have you seen that video?
No, I haven't seen the video, no.
Okay, well,
no, but
it's actually...
Hear about it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that can actually get your high blood pressure going in a heartbeat anytime someone seems to be celebrating the death of young children. So, and specifically, the states of Iowa and Nebraska were cited in that video, which is probably why there was a lot of animosity on both sides at that particular protest. Let me ask you this, because I want to focus on the positive here. In addition to going out to these funerals and waving the flags and basically keeping the families from seeing or hearing this group, and in addition to the Adopt a Soldier program, tell the folks at home the other things that you guys do as a group.
Okay, well, what we're doing aside from the protest is the non-protest funerals. What we do is we follow the procession lines. So we salute when the procession line comes into the the memorial site, we salute the procession line and wave the flags. We got a really good response last funeral I was at from the family. There was nobody from the community there. The only people that were there was our cause, and we had about 25 people there. This was on the west coast of Florida, and I traveled from the east coast of Florida to the west coast and joined over there, and we had about 25 people, and the family was so appreciative of us being there. I can't imagine that what it would have been like had we not been there, and nobody would have been there to see the procession line go into the memorial and nobody be there. I don't understand, because usually when a funeral procession line goes through and a soldier's home, it's all over the news, and you have people from all over the community waving flags, and this is the first time I've ever heard that nobody showed. So we were there, and we saluted them, like I said, and we waved our flags. We waited the whole memorial until they left. We saluted them as they left. We went to the funeral site and did the same thing, waited till the funeral was over, and saluted them when the family left the funeral site. So that's another I think it's a positive thing. Funerals are not supposed to be positive, but when you do such a thing for a family of a soldier, I think it's a very positive thing.
Absolutely. Now, for people who want to get involved in any aspect of your group, whether it's adopting a soldier, showing up at one of the protest funerals, or just one of the funerals for veterans, or any of the other things that you guys are doing, what is the best way for them to contact you and get involved?
Okay, we have a very simple website that you can go to, and it's www.causes.com/POSATS, and that stands for Protectors of Soldiers and Their Families. And when you get on that site, there's a little green button that says join, and you just click on that, and you will be a member.
Fantastic. That sounds easy. Now, are you in a position of, I know at one point you were setting yourself up as a 501c3 so that you could take donations to help these soldiers. Has that been accomplished yet?
We're working on the 501c as we speak. We are taking donations. If you all you have to do is make the check out to POSATF, and I have, if you join, I have the directions on one of the bulletins, the address to send the check to, but we are accepting donations prior to the 501c, just because it takes time in the court system to get the 501c done. But we were having a motorcycle drive coming up here on the 25th of September, and she wound up having an accident. And so we're not having that donation drive. Also, I just want to point out, too, that Kathy Kenta, my co-administrator, her husband just was diagnosed with cancer. And so I'm working the whole cause by myself again. So I'm a pretty busy girl.
So you could use some volunteers. Sounds like you are, Susie. And I got it right that time. I think you got it right when you said after the WBC interview, I kind of had Shirley on the brain for a while, so I apologize. But I'm sorry to hear about Kathy's husband. Please be sure to tell her that we will keep her husband in our prayers. And I have to congratulate you. You were just chosen for the recipient of an honor. Tell us about I forgot the exact name of the award, but
okay.
I know that you've recently.
Yeah, you would love it, and I wish you would come in October 14th through the 16th. It's for the Tea Party Nation, and it's a convention in Las Vegas. And on the second day, on the 15th, they're having a panel for extraordinary people. And they chose me to be on the panel. So somebody was watching me and chose me to be on that panel.
Well, that's because it's very good work that you're doing, and I know the families of these fallen soldiers greatly appreciate the work that you and Kathy and your organization have done. We are out of time, but tell us one more time how people can get in touch with you.
Okay, the website again is www.causes.com/POSATF.
Fantastic. I hope all of you take the steps to get in touch with Shirley and her particular group. Shirley, Susie, thank you. I did it again. I can't stop doing it. Susie, please forgive me. I can't tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing. It's a great, great cause that you've created, and I hope you go on to receive attention, not just at the Tea Party Nation, but also throughout the mainstream media, because I think this cause certainly deserves that type of attention. So, Susie, thank you for being with us, and we look forward to having you back on the show real soon.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that is it for the Tea Party Power Hour today. Of course, just as always, if you want to listen to one of the archived versions, go to teapartypowerhour.com, and you can access all of our shows back to day one. Don't forget, as you're listening to the shows, any books written by the guests will have an icon at the bottom of the page, which you can click on to order a copy of their book. Once again, thank you for being with us. We look forward to seeing you back or having you back next Saturday at the regularly scheduled time of 10 a.m. Central Time.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.